Before I start today, I want to express my appreciation to Walt Markham for this series, because we talked about this 6 months ago, maybe even last year, I don't remember. And the more we talked, the more he said, "This, if you can do something like this," I said, "I'll fake it." No, I said to him. Well, I've taught a course called the Jesus Seminar before at the undergraduate upper division level, so I felt comfortable with the material, and he thought that would be a good idea. So I want to thank him and Barbara, even though they're in absentia. I also want to thank all of you for having such an open mind. This is a topic that a lot of people cannot enter into, because at some level it challenges what are traditional beliefs about the nature of Jesus, especially with regard to the biblical witness and with regard to the creeds and various interpretations that have developed over the years, especially if you stand in the more conservative and especially literalist inerrancy traditions. And I also want to thank the musicians. I mean, it's amazing. Let's give them a really nice round of applause, all of them. It's just, it adds so much. I'm going to spend the entire time on N.T. Wright today and leave hopefully as much time for discussion as possible. I've talked to some of you who haven't been here yet or only once, and you have been following it online, so I'm going to respect that and just not repeat what I've done prior, because I want to spend time on who is probably now the person who is looked upon as the best New Testament scholar with regard to the study of the historical Jesus. He is a bishop in the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church in England. So he comes out of the tradition. And as you know, most of the New Testament scholars, or most of the historical Jesus scholars, are believers. There are some who are not, like Bart Ehrman, whom we talked about last week, who are not necessarily believers, but who do incredibly good historical work. And therefore, we can learn from them, even though they are no longer, he once was, members of the faith. So let's begin. N.T. Wright is a current scholar who emphasizes an innovative method called double similarity and dissimilarity. And this broke really new ground. Up until then, most of the New Testament, I'm going to say historical Jesus scholars, emphasized the dissimilarity between Jesus' views and the surrounding culture, because the assumption was if he'd had similar views, he probably would not have been executed. But it was the dissimilarities that he had, both with the religious culture as well as the political culture, that got him in trouble. And what Wright means when he asks these questions is, how much similarity and dissimilarity is there between what Jesus thought of himself and what the early church thought of him? How much overlap is there? How did the church adapt itself to Jesus' beliefs about himself? And what did the church create theologically about him? Above all, unlike the scholars, especially of the Second Quest, the Third Quest scholars, as we said last week, taped the text of the Bible seriously, although not necessarily literally. That's the best way to think about it. So Wright starts by noting that Jesus was an apocalyptic Jewish restoration eschatologist and a leadership prophet. Like, huh? Well, that's what he was. That's what he is. And that's what he thinks about who Jesus was. He believed, that is, Jesus believed, that the reign of God would soon appear and God would restore Israel to its original mission of being a light of righteousness unto the world, which starts with the 12th chapter of Genesis with the calling of Abraham. That's when the Jewish experiment and the Jewish sense of itself as a chosen people actually does get started. For Wright, Jesus believed, and he's kind of unique in this regard, but as a third quester, he really believes that the best way to understand Jesus is from the context of his Jewish background, and not as a Greek universalist who visited various villages and dispensed universal wisdom. That's more the Second Quest. That's more John Crossan. That's more some of the others. And even people like Marcus Borg, whom we haven't spent a great deal of time in here, call Jesus a kind of a spirit person who was much more interested in a universal conception of God than in the Jewish conception of God. Starting with E.P. Sanders in 1983, as we talked about last time when he wrote Jesus in Judaism, it is pretty now largely accepted that in order to understand Jesus, it's necessary to understand him in his Jewish context, and that his followers later became the ones who were called Christians, or the follower of the Christ or the Messiah who is identified with Jesus, is the way to think of it. He believed that God's reign would soon appear and God would restore Israel. That is, Jesus believed that. And that would restore Israel to its original mission of light of righteousness under the world. For right, Jesus believed, and this is where his innovation differs from others, that Israel was still in exile and that Yahweh or God would soon return to Zion and release Israel from its bondage. Jesus was not concerned about the Romans, but his own Jewish people. Now, this is an unusual interpretation, but Wright believes there's substantial evidence for it in the Bible. What does this mean? We know that the Jews went into Babylonian exile about the year 587. They were there for about 50 years, and after Cyrus the Great conquered the Babylonians, he, as the leader of the new Persian Empire, allowed the Jews to return from their exile in Babylon back to Jerusalem. Some people consider that to be the end of the exile. According to Tom Wright, Jesus did not. According to Tom Wright, Jesus still believed that the Jews were in exile. They went back, for example, into Jerusalem in 538, and the whole Levitican code, the very narrow code that caused the Jews to pull in on themselves, even to the point of advocating that Jewish men divorce their Babylonian women or vice versa, became inward and withdrawn. For N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, Jesus' message, or the message of Judaism, which Jesus was referring to, was that the Jews were meant to be a light unto the world, to give the faith away, not to pull it in and continue a more narrow interpretation, which Wright says Jesus thought right on down to the time of his own life and ministry. So what we have here is that, according to Wright, Tom Wright, Jesus believed that Yahweh was about to return to Zion, Zion being the name for Jerusalem, is another way to think about it. And Jesus was not concerned, as we said, about the Romans, but about his Jewish people. Jesus believed that Jewish society and its leaders were under the control of the devil. This is pretty universally now accepted among Jesus scholars, that the return of Yahweh to Zion would lead to the destruction of the forces of evil, and Yahweh would restore Israel's original mission. Now, for example, think of the passages in the New Testament where Jesus is frequently accused of performing his miracles or his activities under the influence of whom? Beelzebub, or Beelzebul. And he says, which is another name for what? The devil. And Jesus said, this will make any sense. This is not what he said. This is my paraphrase of him. This doesn't make any sense. Why would the devil drive out the devil? Why would the devil drive out the forces of evil? Because if the devil is a symbol of evil, then the devil would not cause the spirits, the evil spirits within people, to come out, to go into the pigs, which then do what? Run into the sea and drown. A very famous passage. Why would the devil drive out the devil? The only way in which evil can be dispersed, dispensed, if you think of it as eliminated, is through not the power of the devil, but the power of Yahweh or God. That is the source of the elimination of evil. And Jesus believed really that the source of the problem was not the Romans. The source of the problem was that the Jewish culture represented through Jerusalem was under the control of the devil. Then he believed that he also would, that as Yahweh would come and would restore the original mission and destroy the forces of evil. Jesus believed that he was the Messiah of some kind. And this is now generally accepted by New Testament scholars. It was not a label that the church applied to him, but it's what he thought of himself. And that well-known passage in the New Testament is the conversation he has with Peter. Whom do you say that I am? And Peter says what? You are the Messiah. And as we know, the Messiah means the anointed one in the tradition of David. And in that particular tradition of David, if we go back to 1 Samuel, it was the prophet Nathan, I believe, who said to David, "There will always be a king on your throne in your name." So when Jesus is called the Messiah, it's a very big deal. He's the anointed one who stands in the tradition of David to be a king on the throne of David's continuing community. That's part of Wright's idea. Now, he believed he was the Son of Man, according to Tom Wright, and that he would become the new king of the restored Israel, and his 12 disciples would become the heads of the restored tribes. It took a while for people to figure out, why 12 disciples? Why not 11? Why not 13? But this number 12 is very significant because there were 12 tribes in the ancient kingdom of Israel under Saul and then David and then Solomon. And then, as you know, it split into the 10 tribes in the north and the 2 tribes in the south. But that's the idea, is that Jesus really believed that as the Messiah, he would stand in that tradition. In addition, the restored Israel would be nonviolent. It would be loving, it would be forgiving and compassionate toward the downtrodden. That's, we talked about last week, the ethic of Jesus and his role in this coming kingdom. Now, as Yahweh's representative, Jesus believed that he had to embody fully the new kingdom perfectionist ethic and show what life would be like in the restored Israel. Number 8, and this is a very interesting idea that Tom Wright proposes. Judas was paid by the priests to reveal what Jesus was privately saying about himself to his disciples, which was that he would be the new king of the Jews. The high priest Caiaphas told Pilate, who had Jesus arrested for treason and crucified for violating Roman law. Now, this is very interesting. When you think about Jesus' crucifixion, there was a sign put up over his cross. What did it say? King of the Jews. King of the Jews. And remember in the Gospel of Mark, he says, "I'm going down to Jerusalem. I'm going to be crucified." He said that 3 times, and then he said what? And don't what? Don't tell anybody. It's called The Messianic Secret. We talked about that as a book written by William Reed in 1901, a very important book. "I am going down there to fulfill my mission as the Messiah. I have to be crucified. It's part of my sort of job description," if you want to think of that, in terms of being chosen by God for this special mission. But don't tell anybody. And so here's Judas, who's in some sense bought off. Now, what most people think is that Judas betrayed Jesus because he thought that Jesus was not a zealot-type revolutionary that was designed to overthrow Romans. According to Tom Wright, that is not what Jesus thought or not what Pilate thought. Pilate was actually bought off to give the secret, the messianic secret, to Caiaphas, who was the head of the priestly establishment at that time, which was responsible for keeping the peace under the control of Pilate. And once Pilate got that information that Jesus was calling himself the king of the Jews, that was an accusation, that was a statement of sedition. And there were laws in the Roman Empire that nobody could propose to be a new king of a new kingdom that would challenge Rome. And when Pilate got that information, that was enough ground to have him arrested and executed, which he did. So he was executed as a criminal for treason, whereas the priest thought he was a false prophet because the Jews at that particular time had a conception of what the prophet or the Messiah would be like. And Jesus did simply not fit that job description. Even to this day, there are many, many Jews who reject Jesus as a Messiah because their Old Testament traditions tell them what kind of Messiah would come to reestablish Zion as a dominant position in the world. At Passover, Jesus had a Last Supper with his disciples. Now, the Last Supper, as you know, there are 2 interpretations of the Last Supper. One is in the Synoptic Gospels and one is in the Gospel of John. In the Synoptics, Jesus has the Last Supper in the evening of Passover. And in the Gospel of John, it's the evening before the Passover, so he can be arrested and die as the Passover lambs are being killed at the Passover or on Passover so he can become the Lamb of God. So there are two different interpretations, two different theological interpretations of that specific event. And then somebody who was sitting over here last week said that she had read something that the Passover and the execution of Jesus were not separated by an evening, but by 6 months. So there are more interpretations increasingly about the relationship of the Passover to when Jesus was actually executed. And as we know, there are two of the oldest traditions in the church. One is the resurrection tradition, and the other is really the Passover tradition, or the "this is my body which is given to you." Those are the two oldest traditions, and others were added later as the church's interpretation, understanding of Jesus began to expand. During the Passover, there occurred a temple incident, which is very famous. He turns over the tables. In the Gospel of John, this occurs at the beginning of his three-year ministry, and in Synoptic Gospels, it's at the end of his one-year ministry, just before he's arrested and executed. So that table incident, virtually all New Testament scholars, even those who come out of the Second Quest, believe actually occurred. There's a broad consensus on this. And the temple incident that led Jesus to Jesus' arrest, Jesus' actions were not meant, now this is, and this is accepted increasingly by the Third Quest people. Jesus' actions were not meant as just a protest against corrupt merchants and moneylenders, but as a symbol that Yahweh was about to destroy the entire corrupt Jewish establishment, temple and all, becoming widely accepted among the scholars, that Jesus had this image that something very, very powerful and transformative was about to occur. Following Isaiah, and this is again N.T. Wright's idea, and this is where the atonement idea becomes significant, and that's why this section is called atonement. Following Isaiah 15:3-11, Jesus believed that as the Son of Man, he had to die to atone for Israel's sins, and that his death would trigger Yahweh's restoration. This view is called messianic woes. That became a part of Jesus' apocalyptic expectations. In Jesus' self-awareness, he believed that he had to die to redeem Israel of its sins. Now, what we're going to see is we're going from the particularity of Jesus' self-ideas to the generalities that the church developed around his self-consciousness is the way to begin to think about this. If you read, for example, in Daniel, the book of Daniel, one of the four great prophets, what are called major prophets rather than minor prophets, especially in chapter 7, if any of you have a Bible handy or on your iPhone or however it is, go to 7, verses 13 and 14. And there you get these images of the Son of Man and so on. Did Jesus appropriate that? Did he appropriate Isaiah 53 as a kind of a suffering servant in terms of messianic woes? N.T. Wright says, without a doubt. The evidence is clear on that, that he had an atonement consciousness, which was very different from what the Jews expected with the zealots, who weren't going there to atone for Israel's sins, but were there to rise up against Rome and expel them in the same way that Judas Maccabees expelled the Seleucids or the Greeks, or that Moses led the children of Israel out of their enslavement in Egypt. After Jesus' crucifixion, some of his followers, disciples, began announcing that he had been resurrected, and this became the cornerstone of the church. The most important persons in the resurrection proclamations are Mary Magdalene and Peter. And of course, a few years later is Paul, so you have Peter, Paul, and Mary. Now, what's interesting about this, it could be, this is interesting speculation, and it may in fact be true that it was Mary Magdalene who started the resurrection tradition. She could be the one who in fact, first to the tomb, saw the empty tomb, and so on and so forth, and said, "Where is he?" And the angel who was sitting there, or the person dressed in a white robe said, "He is what? He's not here. He's risen. He's not here." And then she said, supposedly, was going to keep it a secret, but apparently she didn't keep it a secret very long. But she could be the person responsible for what becomes the cornerstone of the church, which is the earliest resurrection tradition of Jesus. Most people don't give her credit for that. Wouldn't that be amazing? N.T. Wright says there's a high probability that is true. Then Peter joined in, and then the Apostle Paul also voiced that Jesus had appeared to him on his Damascus Road experience and conversion. And one cannot, how do you say it, overemphasize the importance of Paul's conversion. It's one of the great conversions in the history of the world because it led him to his mission out through Asia Minor and into Europe. And when the church, when the Romans captured Jerusalem in the year 70, the church and destroyed the temple, which if Jesus said was going to happen, actually did come to pass, the church had already begun to develop as a result of Paul's direct missionary activities. And he didn't found the church at Rome. The legends are that Peter founded it, even though his greatest letter is the letter to the Romans, where he develops his theology, his incarnational theology fully. But it's a pivotal moment in church history. For right then, Jesus is seen in this way. Most of the New Testament beliefs about him fit together quite well, is the way to think of it. And the church did not so much make up its view of Jesus as adapt itself to Jesus' view of himself in relationship to his first century Jewish setting. The process of adaptation begins and builds on the proclamation, maybe Mary Magdalene's proclamation, of the empty tomb and integrates numerous aspects of how Jesus defined himself and his mission. Good stuff. Good stuff. Good thinking. I wish I'd have written some of this stuff, but we have it here and we can enjoy it. Now, here is basically how do we begin to think about adaptations. Think of it this way. Think of it as a puzzle where you've got a lot of pieces sitting around and you begin to put them together. Because the Bible is made up of lots of pieces and traditions that are all woven together throughout the text, especially in the Gospels, which is our primary source. There are integrations, then there are adaptations, and then there are extensions to the adaptations. That's the process to think about and how the church came to identify Jesus the way in which we understand him through the kerygma. Here it is. Jesus focused on Israel. The church focused on all of humanity. It was from the particular to the universal. So Jesus' focus gave the church and the followers, his followers, the opportunity to extend beyond Israel his views to all of humanity. He saw himself as Israel's Messiah. The church saw him as humanity's Messiah or Savior of the world. Jesus focused on the king himself as a new king of an older or restored covenant, and he becomes the king of a new covenant. That's why we have the Old Testament, the New Testament, because the Old Testament is called the Old Covenant, and the New Testament is called the New Covenant, even though from a Christian perspective, which Jews do not really accept, the Old Testament foretold or forecast the coming of a Messiah whom the Christians, rejected by the Jews, considered to be Jesus. That's how we would work it. Jesus saw himself as the Son of Man, and the church converted him to the Son of God. Now, this is a two-lecture conversation. How that process happened is very critical in the development of the early church. And I suggest that one of the best scholars, and there not everybody agrees on this, this is a very interesting part of how the church began to work with the memory of Jesus, who saw himself as the Son of Man. If Jesus had called himself equivalent to God, probably in the Jewish tradition, he would have been thought of as anathema, because no human being could be identified with God. It was considered to be persona non grata. It was a violation that there's only one single God, and that is Yahweh. And it took a while for the Trinity, as we know, to develop. So what we have here is the Son of Man going to the Son of God. Here is basically the steps that which that happened. Jesus becomes the Son of God as his resurrection. Remember that he was resurrected between two thieves. They were supposedly thieves. Many people think that they were thieves in the sense of stealing money, but the word thief really meant bandit, and the word bandit meant zealot. So he really was buried between two zealots. And what did one of them say to him? Truly, this is the Son of God. It begins there. Then you can back up even before his resurrection and you get to his baptism, which occurs in Mark. When he's baptized, the sky opens up, the cloud, what's his voice? This is my beloved son, whom I'm well. Then you go to the birth stories, right? You back it up even further from the baptism into the birth. Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit and born of the Virgin Mary. Why? Because he was God at birth. He was the Son of God at birth, and therefore his birth was very special. By the time you get to the prologue of the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and all of creation was made through that Word. So you go from the resurrection to the baptism to the birth to the pre-existent Christ who becomes the Son of God. This is fun reading. And then one of the persons who traces that development from Son of Man to Son of God through the mind of the church, it's an adaptation to what Jesus thought of himself and an expansion to a universalist principle, which is identified as the Son of God. Jesus believed he was atoning for the sins of Israel. The church thought he was, and still does, was atoning for the sins of everyone, all of humanity. Jesus' perfectionist ethic was just retained. And Jesus believed, for example, that he embodied what the new kingdom would be like. And if it's nonviolent, he had to be a nonviolent person. That's why we find in the Sermon on the Mount, you have heard it said. There are six you have heard it saids in the fifth chapter. And the fifth one is, you have heard it said, an eye and a tooth for tooth, and I say to you, what? Do not resist the evildoer. Right? Last week I slapped myself on one cheek and this big boom went off. As a result, someone asks you for your coat, what do? Give them two, he asks you, and so on. Go a mile, you go 2 miles. You've heard it said, right? This is the last of the six. You shall love your friends and your neighbors, and you should hate whom? Your enemy. And what does Jesus say? You should do what? Pray for your enemies. Because remember, the sun falls not only on the just, but it also falls on the unjust. Right. And God will take care of it. This was Jesus' view. Jesus had an extraordinary relationship to God. And he believed God was in charge of the whole transformation that was about to take place and that he had been called into a special role to lead that transformation, which ultimately led to his own crucifixion and his belief that that would atone for the sins of Israel, which the church then later thought would atone for the sins of the world. All right, I think this is the last one. I think, slide 9. And then we have actually 15 minutes for good Q&A. The church is, now remember, integration of the pieces, adaptation of the pieces, and then extension of the pieces in order to complete the life and picture of Jesus, according to Tom Wright. Here they are. Here are the extensions. The birth stories in Matthew and Luke are extensions to try to define the relationship of the Son of God label to when Jesus was born. Now, we celebrate Christmas on when? December 25th. Well, most scholars don't think Jesus was born on December 25th. They really think he was born in the spring in Nazareth and not in in the little town of Bethlehem, because in the Old Testament it's predicted that the coming of the Messiah would be born where? In Bethlehem. So that gets woven into the story. But most New Testament, and especially Jesus scholars, think he was born in Nazareth up there, spent his whole life up there in the Nazareth area before he went to see John, his cousin, supposedly, and got baptized and so on. So the birth stories are an extension, because nobody really knows how Jesus was born, and he doesn't come on the scene until he's 30 years old, except for Luke, where he has, at age 12, that incident where he encounters the Pharisees and his family lose him after the Passover. You know, they had six kids or something, and somehow they forgot Joseph when they started heading back to the Galilee, which is that area up there. Where's Yeshua? That's his name, Yeshua, which could be interpreted as Joshua or Jesus. So Jesus' real name might have actually been Joshua. Could it go either way? He could have been one or the other. But we know of him, of course, as Jesus. But the birth stories are extensions of the adaptation. The pre-existent Christ prologue in John is an extension. The ascension into heaven is an extension. Why the ascension into heaven? If Jesus showed up in the first few days after, for example, his crucifixion to some people, why didn't he keep showing up? The answer is what? Ascension. So that's next. Coming, the second coming, if he ascended, he'll come back. The realized eschatology means that his church here right now is his kingdom on earth until he comes again, which is a future eschatology in the second coming. And Christ's kingdom, by the time you get to John, when John goes before Herod, which is the only gospel in which he goes before Herod, and Herod says, are you the king of a new kingdom? He says, my kingdom is what? Not of this world. It's of a different world. So there is an extension of the kingdom that's going to be transformed in history as a result of restoring the ancient Israel to its path of righteousness. And now suddenly the kingdom is not of this world. And of course, the church becomes Christ's kingdom on earth. We are part of Christ's kingdom on earth, even though we are all what? Lost sheep, so to speak. Think of Jesus or Christ as the shepherd of 90, of 100 sheep, and all 99 are in good shape. Then there's that one sheep, right, that's lost. And what does the shepherd go do? Look and look and look until what? He finds that one sheep. That's really what Jesus, that's what we are in some sense. We go looking for Jesus. Guess what? Guess who's looking for us first? The other way around. It's God who comes to us, and of course, John Wesley called it prevenient grace. God keeps working on you until you have that moment of justifying grace, which leads to sanctifying grace. That's why I like John Wesley. He got it in some sense, that God is always working on it before we get to justifying grace. And then finally, the Trinity develops over time, and that too is about a four-hour discussion, how that happens. So we're done with N.T. Wright. Remember, we went through this sort of minimalist reductionist second quest. The third quest goes back. It becomes integrationist, becomes an extension, and it becomes an adaptation, and then it becomes an extension. And we are now in the position of saying that the church's view of who Jesus was through the creed and the kerygmas is really built on what Jesus thought of himself. That is, the idea of Christ is not made up by the church. The idea of Jesus as the Christ builds on Jesus' own self-concepts. And that seems to be where the quest for the historical Jesus stands right now, and just how much of what the church thinks of him and what he thought of himself, while it is still under discussion to try to parse it all out in nice little pieces, it is generally accepted now that the church's adaptations and extensions and integrations are built upon what he thought of himself, that is, his own self-consciousness. Questions? Yes, sir, Charles.
To what extent do schools like Perkins identify with the theory versus the old
fundamentals? Well, we have a professor from Perkins here today who's a professor of church history, and I duly turn the tables over to him.
We have a huge variety, but none that I know of would be the old-fashioned fundamentalists. I mean, we have some of the kind of older-style liberals that would be more like what you call the second.
That's correct.
And a lot who resonate with Tom Wright. I'm delighted to get your comments, because I had Tom for Greek, but I never got any of this stuff from him. And all I got was aorist and singular and plural and stuff like that.
Right, well, exactly. Well, it was all Greek to me, too. I mean, I have the same idea. But once his two books, if you want to read Tom Wright, go back to 1992 and 1996. Those are the New Testament and Jesus books that he wrote. Now, remember, E.P. Sanders was 1983, so you've got about a 10-year gap in there. But give E.P. Sanders the credit for Open Up the Third Quest. He was terrific in identifying Jesus as a Jew. And Tom Wright is in the church, but he has a deep, deep respect. By the way, Tom Wright thinks, in some sense, that Paul got it wrong. He thinks that when Paul turned him into the Savior of this world, Christ died while we were yet sinners, and so on, that wasn't who Jesus was. Jesus believed the world was going to be transformed in his time, right? And that God would intervene in that restoration process. And Paul took it in a different direction, which later becomes, my kingdom is not of this world. It's a more of an incarnational view. Then Jesus probably thought of himself more on the human side rather than the divine side. And through Paul, we begin to see the development of the divine side of Jesus in addition to the scriptural, that is the gospel, attempt to identify him as a person in history, as a real human being. Male, I'm going to go boy, girl, boy, girl. We had one boy, Charles. Do we have a female? Yes.
Mm-hmm. To restore Israel, and on the other hand, as the sacrificial, having to die.
Well, he thought he had to atone as the king.
Atone.
Yeah, he had to atone for the sins of Israel. Now, he was from this tribe of Judah. It's frequently referred to as the stump of Jesse. Most people say, well, who's Jesse? Well, Jesse was David's father. And therefore, if he's from the stump of Jesse, then he's coming through the Davidic lineage, and he stood in the Judaic, the tribe of Judah. The southern kingdom only had two tribes. The 10 tribes were wiped out in 722 when the Assyrians sacked them, never to be seen from again in history. Whereas the southern two tribes were Benjamin and Judah, and Jesus comes down through the Judah tribe. So he and the New Testament writers, when they do the genealogies, go to great lengths to tie him back to David. That's very, very clear, because if he's going to be the Messiah, he has to stand in that tradition. But in addition to that, if we read the 53rd chapter of Isaiah and the 7th chapter of Daniel in particular, no longer is the Messiah in the tradition of David. For example, Saul killed his thousands and David killed his tens of thousands. David had the reputation of being a tremendous warrior. Jesus was not a warrior. He was in the tradition, but he was in the Isaic tradition of the suffering servant, the atoner who had to die for the sins of Israel, and that would be the trigger point where Yahweh would intervene and make the transformation and put him in the king of the restored kingdom, which is what Jesus anticipated. And then the church built on that notion of atonement and that Jesus was the Messiah, he's also the king. Now, in addition, it's been pointed out that in the ancient world, Caesar was the king, so to speak. So it was easy when Christianity spread out to replace King Jesus, or to replace King Caesar with King Jesus. Because that form, as it's called, in terms of form criticism, which is one of the basis on which New Testament and Jesus scholars do their work, was already in place culturally. So I could say to you, if I'm trying to convert you, Caesar is not your king. Jesus is your king. And he is the Christ, and he's the Messiah, and he's God's chosen one with a special purpose. Boy, girl, who's the... There were so many hands. I don't want to offend anybody. Who's next? Do you remember whose hand went up next? Okay, sir.
I've got a concern.
Can you speak a little louder, sir?
I have a concern about talking about what Jesus thought and believed, because it seems to me it involves a leap, or at least a movement of several steps, from the words of Jesus as recorded in the New Testament, okay, to what Jesus himself believed about himself. Is there discussion in some of this
Absolutely.
Writing about that assumption?
This is a critical question. If you didn't hear this, this is very, very important. He talks about how can we be certain that what Jesus said of himself was really true as opposed to what the gospel writers maybe made him think. Most people who do Jesus studies operate at three levels. The first level is, oh my goodness. The first, we don't need it on. Oh, there it is. Let there be light, and here it comes. Okay, thank you very much. Back there. Oh, by the way, I forgot to thank the people down there in the back of the room who make all this possible, and we thank you very much for the contribution you have made. But to go back to his story, the questers, as they're called, believe that there are three levels of operation. The first one is what we call the kerygma. That is what we say when we say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, which we did in church this morning as well as in our class. Then there is the reconstruction, the historical reconstruction of Jesus based upon the four primary sources, which are our gospel, plus you can say the Gospel of Thomas, which people in the second quest, like John Crossan, for example, and Marcus Board believe ought to be taken into consideration because they take into consideration the sayings of Jesus, but not the narrative of his life as is developed in Mark and elsewhere. So there is the kerygma Jesus, there is the scholar's reconstruction of the historical Jesus, and then there is that third level, which is the real Jesus. And what we think about the real Jesus, we can only get to through some view of the historical Jesus. But whether or not the issues that you're raising are simply still grafting over who he was without really penetrating to the deepest possible level is one of those issues that remains unanswered. In some sense, we'll never know the real Jesus. What we're getting are various views, as was pointed out earlier, of the historical Jesus. Unless you're a literalist and you just believe it's all literally true, in which case you've got to deal with the contradictions. But that's another story altogether. When it comes to a reconstruction of Jesus, we have very limited resources because he never wrote anything down. And the first person who wrote about him was Paul in 1 Thessalonians, which is generally considered to be the oldest, you know, what do you want to call it, book in the New Testament. It's really a letter. And he wasn't interested in the historical Jesus. He was interested in Jesus' theological mission and his purpose for being on earth as one who dies for the sins of the world, and while we were yet sinners, he died for us, and so on. That's a very, very good question. In some sense, we'll never know the real Jesus, but we are getting, we think, closer by knowing the historical Jesus, but we have to remember, and this is also another way to think about it. The historical, and we said this many times, the historical Jesus that we see is sometimes the Jesus we want to see. Because we take all kinds of assumptions into our work and our analysis. And if you don't believe that science can be reconciled with the miracles, every time you read a miracle story that violates the laws of nature, you say it couldn't have happened. They have to have another explanation. So you end up with a Jesus who didn't really perform miracles. And you start out with the assumption that it couldn't be done. So you are concluding what you already believe at the start. It's called circular logic. So we find the Jesus in there that we, in some sense, want to find based upon our own assumptions. We have 2 minutes. One more question. Was that boy, girl, boy, girl? Was that okay, girl? Okay.
What about when Jesus went to Samaria and told the woman at the well about how he was the Messiah and said that the Jews understood about God, but he more declared himself to the woman at the well, and the Samaritans were not Jews, but he said that he was available to the Samaritans as well as to the Jews.
That's clearly in the Gospel of John. The so-called well stories really show up in the Gospel of John, and the Gospel of John is written near the end of the first century. It's probably sometime around 90, 95. Some people think as late as 110, whereas the first gospel written was Mark, followed by Matthew, followed by Luke, sometime between, let's say, 60 or 65 and 85. So John comes along with the whole idea of the Son of God is developing, and in the pre-existence prologue, Jesus is considered to be with God from the beginning. When he meets the woman at the well, most scholars hate to say this about the Gospel of John, don't believe there's one word of historical authenticity in the Gospel of John. That's tough to take, but most do not. They think it's a theological reconstruction based upon 7 or 8 amazing miracles, the last of which he raises Lazarus from the dead in 3 days, and then his kingdom, he announces, is not of this world. And those are the passages that include the I am. I am the bread of the world. I am the vine. That's what you get in John, the I am passages. There are no I am passages in the Synoptic Gospels, and there are no parables in the Gospel of John. So the question is, why does the Gospel of John use the I am by which Jesus identifies himself? Who's the I am in the Old Testament? Moses says, who shall I say sent me? What does the bush come back with? Tell them, I am sent me. Well, If the I Am in the Old Testament is sending them, guess who the I Am in the New Testament is? Jesus. So when Moses is talking to the bush, it's really Jesus who's telling him, I am. That's the connection. That's the leap between the Old and the New Testament. And New Testament scholars put a great deal of effort in tying the historical Jesus, or the Jesus that they understood, back to Old Testament passages. For example, I just did a study of Paul. There are 62 references that Paul makes in his letters, his 7 authentic letters. There are 6 that are questionable. 62 back to the Old Testament. You have heard it said this was going to happen, and guess what? It did in Jesus. 62 of them. Some people call it proof texting and so on and so forth, but it's clearly extending the life of Jesus backward to the Old Testament to try to find passages that the Old Testament foretold in terms of the coming of the Christ. Does that answer? I'm sorry if I confused you. I have this tendency to do this from time to time. But thank you all very much. I've spoken too much. It has been great.